Tonight I thought we would speak about a subject that I spoke about in Los Angeles on Thursday, to some extent, but other angles can always be considered, as any theme in Bhagavatam is unlimited, because Krishna is unlimited, and Bhagavatam is the literary presence of Lord Krishna. I'm thinking of verses in the 8th canto, the first chapter. Prayers recited by Swayambhuva Manu as he stood on the bank of a river on one leg for quite a long time. These were his austerities. And while he was practicing those austerities, he recited various prayers. And one of them was that although we don't see the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he always sees us. So we shouldn't assume that just because we don't see him, that therefore he doesn't exist, or that he's not seeing us. The process of bhakti is for repairing our eyesight, so that indeed we can detect the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The repair on the eyesight actually begins by repairing the ears. As you know, you see by hearing in bhakti. First you hear. And there's no qualitative difference between hearing about Krishna and seeing Krishna. This is a mysterious point in our so-called culture, Western culture. We're so hung up on eyesight. Eye candy, they call it. But the bhakti tradition is ear candy. By hearing properly, you're actually seeing. So Swayambhuva Manu explains that regardless of whether we can detect the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supreme Personality of Godhead always exists. The example Srila Prabhupada gives in the purport is, you don't always see the sun. Now you don't see the sun. Does that mean the sun doesn't exist? So then why should you conclude that just because you don't see Krishna, that Krishna doesn't exist? In his prayers, Swayambhuva Manu also explains how the Lord is the witness of everything. He's always awake. So what is our situation? The Bhagavatam explains that even when we think we are awake, we are actually still dreaming. As you know, we have the phase of the daydream, and then the phase of the night dream. And at the time of complete cosmic annihilation, we enter a deep state of dreaming. So all phases of conditioned life involve dreaming. We're not awake. Although the conditioned souls go through all these various phases of being not awake, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is always awake. Therefore, if we take knowledge from that always awake, eternal Supreme Person, we can be safe in this most dangerous world. The question can come up. We were discussing this in New Dwarka on Thursday. How can it be just that we don't remember precisely the activities in our past life that brought about suffering at the hands of karma in this life? This doesn't seem to be proper jurisprudence, a proper system of justice. Particularly those, we explained Thursday, who are in nations where liberal democracy supposedly predominates. People expect that the courts are honest, and that when you're brought before the judge after being apprehended for doing something wrong, the legal system, the representative of the legal system, the judge points out, you did such and such and such and such, the jury has decided, and therefore for that particular crime, here is the particular punishment. And often the judge may give some personal admonishment. Why did you do such a horrible thing? You should learn your lesson. So, we have this kind of cultural expectation of the way Krishna should do things. And we assume that it's like an absolute expectation. We assume that it's the way things should be, without understanding that this expectation may be an inbuilt cultural expectation about the way justice supposedly functions in Western societies. So I was explaining a little bit on Thursday how actually this Western liberal democracy conception of justice is not prevalent in the entire world. Most countries in the world, people don't expect such a type of justice. I explain how there's one devotee in southern Russia, and he was a criminal prosecutor. He's a lawyer and meant to prosecute criminals. And so I asked him, is it possible that any kind of court decision happens in Russia without bribes? And he thought a long time and said, you know, sometimes it happens. Sometimes it happens. And then he began to explain that he gets so tired of his job because he's a lawyer, he went to the university and studied law, but the reality is that all he does day in and day out is simply arrange bribes. That's what a lawyer does in that situation. He just arranges the bribes. How much? You did this, therefore that'll cost you that much. We'll see what we can do behind the scenes. I'll talk to the judge. We grease the palm of the judge a little bit, and you'll be all right. So where is the justice? The point is, you should know better than to ever come anywhere near a legal situation. Because once you enter into legal situations, voluntarily or involuntarily, who knows how it's going to turn out? And innocent or guilty doesn't matter. You gotta pay. So the whole point is, don't come anywhere near anything to do with the legal system. It's got nothing to do with justice. Just stay away from any potential situation that involves the police or the courts, and you'll be all right. So here we see a completely different understanding of jurisprudence, a completely different understanding of how justice and punishment should work. No one expects fair treatment in the courts. The concept doesn't exist. The whole point is avoid any possible interaction with the legal system. One devotee in Ukraine told me a true story. It involved him. His father died and left him a small apartment, one-bedroom apartment. But in Ukraine, that's like, wow, you inherited a small apartment. Oh, happy day. You've made it big. But his father had been separated from his mother. And so the mother, his own mother, she began to plot, along with her brothers, the devotee's uncles. Why should he get this apartment? We should give it, you know, to a niece or something like that. You know, he's a Hare Krishna. What's he going to do with an apartment? Why did the father leave him the apartment? So his own mother and uncles began to conspire against him, and they took him to court. And their whole presentation in court was that how can this person be a legitimate inheritor when he's practicing some strange religion from India? And most likely, even though he has inherited this apartment, he can go off to India anytime. That's the way his religion functions. And he'll just go off to India, and who knows what will happen to the apartment. So he's a very irresponsible person because of practicing this kind of religion. And therefore, the court should annul the inheritance and let us decide who in the family gets the apartment. Now, of course, in the USA, that would be a ridiculous argument. But in justice in that part of the world, it's not about the argument, it's about the money. Who pays the judge the most money is right, and everyone knows that. So the mother and her brothers were plying the judge, and naturally the devotee also had to pay the judge. The devotee's motivation was he wanted the small apartment to be an ISKCON center in his small city, because ISKCON had no place there in that small city. So that was his motivation. Otherwise, he's single and he didn't have any desire of his own, but he wanted to that property to be used as a center. So he fought it out. They bribed the judge, he bribed the judge. It was like a neck and neck battle. No clear winner except for the judge. Raking it in from all sides. Okay, keep paying. Let's see who's going to win. Let's see where justice will be. So, after about a half year of this, his mother invited him over for dinner. She said that it was like a peace dinner. Look, we have gone through so much havoc in our family. We have gone through so much rancor. Let's try to, disarm and once again restore family ties. After all, I am your mother and you're my son. So the devotee was, well, this sounds nice, okay. And he went over and his mother had prepared dinner. Normally, he was a strict brahmachari, so he wouldn't eat anything cooked by non-devotees. But he considered that for this case, for this situation, for Krishna's service, if I get that apartment for ISKCON, I'm willing to be a little flexible, eat mother's cooking. So he sat down to eat, and mother was very considerate. She even had gotten like a special water pot from an Indian shop, one of those water pitchers, from India, and copper to add minerals to the water. And so he was very pleased with that. So he drank some water and he ate some food, and within 5 minutes he was on the floor writhing and his head was spinning. His mother had put, psychiatric drugs in the water to just spin his mind, and put poison in the food. And so as he's just writhing on the floor, his own mother, the true story, own mother and uncles are standing over him. Die! 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 And so he's brought to the hospital. And indeed, the doctors expected him to die, but somehow he survived, much to their astonishment. And when he got out of the hospital, of course, his mother and uncles were astonished. They kept a low profile. They didn't, naturally, they certainly didn't come and wish him, happy recovery. And so then it went back to the court battle. And the devotee was now determined. I've got to get this apartment for ISKCON, so ISKCON can have a center in this small city. And so somehow or other, he was able to get more money, and he won the payoff match in terms of who could pay the judge the most. And so the judge gave the favor in his decision. gave the decision in his favor, I'm sorry. And he was the winner. I asked him, well, what happened to your mother? What did she do after that? And he said, basically, she went crazy. I mean, you know, just poisoning her own son. Even from the material point of view, was just mad. And so indeed, she went mad. And so now, ISKCON has a nice little center in that Namhata center in that small city. So people expect it in that part of the world. This is the way justice is. So it's not that the kind of the Western liberal conception where you should be punished exactly for your crime, if indeed you did the crime, and you should know exactly what you did wrong, how you did wrong, so that when you're punished, you won't make that mistake again. So persons often say, how is it that karma can be fair if you don't remember exactly what you did in your past life that caused the suffering, the present suffering in this life? That's improper. That's an improper jurisprudence, improper justice system. Mm. But even from the material point of view, I was explaining in Los Angeles that this liberal Western democratic conception is not prevalent in the world. There's so many countries in the world. I travel to them all the time. People say, for example, so many countries in South America, if your home's been burgled, don't call the police. Because if you call the police, they'll come and take whatever's left. This is just a basic fact of life. So why is it that some other people think this conception of justice is a universally operating reality? It is not. That you should be fully aware of what you did wrong, and then you are punished, and you can match the wrongdoing you did with the punishment, and you can see, I should never do this again. So people think karma should function like that. Why should it be that way? Just because we arbitrarily think like that through our cultural precepts. Let's look at the situation more deeply. First of all, it is not the job of Maya to educate you. This is one of the faulty misconceptions at the basis of this mix-up. We expect that there's something in the material energy that's going to educate us. Now, you did this before, and therefore, you're being punished. But it is not the job of the material energy to educate anyone. What is the purpose of the material energy? To bewilder you. To cover you. Now, you might say, that's not fair. Why is the material energy doing that to me? Why doesn't the material energy give me a fair go? Give me justice as I perceive it. But remember, you shouldn't have jumped into the material energy. Just like if you're living in North Korea, do you expect sanity from the government? So Krishna has told us straight out, the material energy is set up to bewilder us and to thwart our endeavors. So we jumped in to this polluted lake, and then we expect fairness. Why does it have to work that way? Why can't it work another way? So let's try to see from other angles how the system is fair and how the system works. Let's forget the notion that you're supposed to learn by material experience. We all know the maxim that everyone's forgotten, the second half. Experience is the best teacher. And what's the other half? For a fool will learn no other way. And that is the actual other half of the maxim, according to Western tradition. But no one remembers that other half. Can fools actually learn by experience? No. There's nothing about experience in the material energy in of itself that will educate you and enlighten you. Simply that material experience produces fatigue. And sometimes, in your fatigue state, in your beaten down state, if you come across a devotee, you're able to listen. Sometimes, not all the time. What you generally see is that when people are beaten down, when jivas are beaten down by the material energy, they pick themselves right back up and got to try harder. You'll be more successful next time. It's like professional sports stars. They always talk like that. You've got to triumph over the adversity. That's all a part of the game. So people think life works like that. And that's how the material energy should deal with you. But no. There's no illumination given by the avidya potency. The avidya potency means just what it says. Nescience, darkness, you're covered over. So then you might think, how can I reform myself if I don't know the exact correspondence between my present suffering and what I did in the past? Sometimes people say that because that awareness is not there, it shows that, number one, the system of karma is faulty, or number two, the person behind the system of karma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is faulty, or number three, the system doesn't even exist because it's ludicrous that you suffer and don't remember precisely what you did to bring about that suffering. Let's look at things from a different point of view. What has Krishna done to educate us, although the material energy is not educating us? First of all, the Lord is present in everyone's heart, no matter what body you take. How much care can you expect than that? Such loving care that even if you take the lowest kind of body, the Lord is there as the supersoul. And then secondly, although the material energy is not constructed to give you awareness, in fact, what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Mudha janmani janmani. Not one birth a fool, but birth after birth a fool. That's what contact with the material energy produces. We were discussing this concept in Los Angeles in relation to the dialogue between the Yama Dutas and the Vishnu Dutas. The Vishnu Dutas, in preventing the Yama Dutas from snatching the soul of Ajamil from the core of his heart, they said to the Yama Dutas, "Can you tell us what is real religion? What is Dharma?" Because the Yamadutas were saying, "We're just doing our duty. It's plain as day to see that this Ajamil is a sinner and he must come before Yamaraj." So why are you beautiful beings? And we admit you are extraordinarily beautiful. Why are you stopping us? It's obvious. So then the Vishnu Dutas asked, "Do you know what real religion is?" And so the Yamadutas began to defend themselves and articulating so brilliantly the arrangement of the material energy and how the conditioned souls automatically get problems from the material energy, whether they're problems on the heavenly planets or problems on the middle planets or problems in hell. The contact with the material energy is the downfall of the soul. The Yamadutas explain, "You may be acting piously now. You may even be in the heavenly planets right now. But the way the material energy is designed, we're going to get you sooner or later." Because just by your contact with the material energy, you've got to slip up at some point. It may be in one birth, it may be in 100 births, sooner or later we get everyone. Because that's the way the material energy is set up. Now you may say, well, that's not fair. But why did you jump into such a situation? Just like we were explaining, when we were talking about this devotee in Russia who's a criminal prosecutor, he explains, everyone should know, don't do anything that gets you anywhere near any involvement with the police or the courts, because you're going to get shafted. Do anything except get involved with the legal system. Because as soon as you just get one toe into the legal system, you got problems. Doesn't matter whether you are guilty or innocent, just by your contact with the legal system, you're going to get screwed. So therefore, any intelligent, practical person in the country knows, whatever you do, don't come near a policeman, don't go near a court. Doesn't, right or wrong has nothing to do with it. The wrong thing is that you came anywhere near a policeman or the court system. Material energy is treacherous like that. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Karanam Gunasangasya Sadasadyo Nijanmasu. The cause is contact with material nature. That's the cause of the problems as you wander through different species of life under the influence of the modes of nature. The cause of the problems is contact with material nature. But we have a hard time accepting that because it doesn't fit with our Western conceptions of justice. Look, we're in the legal system. We should be treated fairly. And the legal system should inform you exactly what you did wrong and how the punishment matches that. And the average person, at least in liberal Western democracies, they think that's the way things go on. So, Krishna is there as the super soul. That takes away our argument that the system's not fair, because the Lord in the heart is always trying to get you to turn to Him. Number two, we have the Shastra. In other words, the illuminating factor in material existence is not experience, and it certainly is not the material energy. It's the Shastra. The Shastra itself tells us that. So you're not supposed to turn to material energy and say, enlighten me. You're supposed to turn to the Shastra. But because we don't take Shastra seriously, therefore, we look for justice and fairness within the material energy, which actually is madness. Whoever told us that the material energy should be fair and should be illuminating and educating? It's not the educational department of the Lord. It's the bewildering, covering department. Oh, for us to get that through our heads, how many births do we have to go through? It's not the number of births. It's, do we come in contact with Shastra? And number three, do we come in contact with a devotee? So this is how Krishna has arranged the system. That the material energy will not educate you, no matter how much experience you have with it. It is the Shastra that educates you, and contact with a devotee that brings about illumination. And then the super soul is always present with you in the core of your heart. Ishwar Sarva Bhutanam. No matter how many different types of bodies you take. So we have to look at things from another point of view besides our Western conceptions of how things should be done. And even in our Western liberal democracies, we don't really know all the cheating that's going on. Just like my youngest brother, who's the general counsel for Toyota and vice president in terms of government compliance and legal affairs and all that kind of thing. He was telling me what was really going on behind the 8 million car recall and the fine by the government of $25 million. He said basically the government was double dipping. They were making a profit because they owned General Motors, and then they're fining Toyota. At least this is Toyota's vision of it. And they're making a profit by fining Toyota. There were a few things wrong, but nothing warranted such an attack other than politics, beat up on a foreign corporation, and making some money. So, you might think $25 million, well, that'll teach them a lesson. My brother's attitude, he actually signed a check. $25 million, why are they bothering with us? Why are they bothering us with this, these politicians? This is how arrogant things get at such levels of business and finance. Oh, $25 million. Okay, if this is what they want, and they'll stop bugging us, all right, just write the pet check for a few pennies, and that'll be the end of it. So, even in our Western liberal democracies, we really don't know what's going on. But we have this conception that there should be fairness, and there will be fairness, and if it's not, we get offended. So then we take that same material conception of how the court should function in a small part of the world, and we apply that to how Krishna should do things, when Krishna has a much better system. What does Uddhava pray? He says, great saints and sages cannot properly express their indebtedness, their gratitude to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because he delivers the conditioned soul in two ways, as the super soul in the heart and as the acharya from without. And then there's also the shastra. So that's Krishna's way of bringing about justice within an unfair world. Krishna's justice system is not part of the world. The super soul, the devotee, the shastra, they're not part of the material world. But that's where the justice comes in. That's where the fairness comes in. How do you know that you made a mistake in your past life and you shouldn't make that mistake again? Not by experience, but by the shastra. Then you may say, but wouldn't it be better? And this is our cultural bias. Wouldn't it be better that we knew exactly what we did in the past life that brought about a certain event in this life? Like, what was it, the case of Manduka Muni? Is that his name? Yes, he pierced an ant with a piece of straw. And so, or in the month of Kartika, we're aware of Nalakuva and Manigriva. They were doing things that today would be considered first class. They're having a little fun. A little intoxication and bathing in the rivers with, you know, beautiful young ladies who no one happened to have clothes. Well, this is like peak moment of life. So then what happened? The shastra says, yudhichchaya. By chance or by good fortune. It's the same thing from the shastric point of view. Chance is not the same as Western conceptions of just random, meaningless events happening. By chance means by one's sweet will. Narada Muni, by his sweet will, is wandering here and there, spreading auspiciousness wherever he goes. So, he happened to this place where Nalakuva and Manigriva were absorbed in sinful activity, even while bathing in the Ganga. And Narada Muni considered, what to do? The question asked by Shona Gurishi of Sutta Goswami was, wait a minute, Narada Muni, he's supposed to be a topmost sadhu. How did he get angry enough to curse the sons of Kuvera? But actually, what Narada Muni did, as you know, was a simultaneous curse blessing. So even the anger of Narada Muni produces nothing but 100% auspicious effects. So Narada Muni considered the best way to deal with this situation of these boys, these sons of Kuvera, who became so puffed up, especially by wealth. In Narada Muni's opinion, it's the wealth that is the most detrimental out of the four opulences of Janmaishvara Shutashribir. Aristocratic birth, wealth, high learning, and personal beauty. Narada Muni said, it's the wealth that is the most detrimental, and that you just don't care because you're so wealthy. So, as you know, he cursed the boys to be Yamala Arjun trees. And he also gave them the benediction that they would remember exactly what happened, even though they were in tree bodies. And of course, eventually they get the blessing of seeing face to face Supreme Personality Godhead Krishna in Vrindavan. So we might think, well, there you go. That is justice. That's the big deal right there. That's what we should focus on. Narada Muni gave them the ability to remember what they did in a previous life, getting intoxicated and bathing unclad, young girls, and therefore they're standing as trees. Okay, we can accept that. That's the main point, but it isn't the main point. If you look at things from the viewpoint of Srimad Bhagavatam, it is not the main point. The main point is simply the mercy of Narada Muni. That's the main point. And it's just that, as a little side benefit, Narada Muni threw that thing in there. You'll remember exactly what you did. But we just seize upon that one. Oh, yes, that's the proper functioning of life in this world. We should remember exactly what we did and why we're being punished, why we're suffering karmic reactions in this life. But no. When Krishna knocked down the Yamala Arjun trees, his motivation, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said, was not because these boys were sons of Kuvera. In fact, Vishwanath says, Krishna was thinking, what do I have to do? I don't have anything to do with these rich boys. These sons of Kuvera? I've got nothing to do with them. But because of the words of my devotee, Narada Muni, I'm going to do something about this. I'm beholden to the words of my devotee, Narada Muni. So, in other words, Krishna was not directly acting upon these boys because of the boys. The direct connection was the mercy of Narada Muni. So, when Nalakuva and Manigriva burst out of the trees in their shining forms as devas and were offering prayers to Krishna, they thanked Narada Muni for what Narada Muni had done. They were fully aware that it's only because of the mercy of Narada Muni that we are where we are now, face to face with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they didn't particularly glorify the fact that they could remember exactly what they did. They glorified the mercy of Narada Muni, who had apparently by chance, but nothing happens by chance as commonly conceived. There's a reason for everything. Narada Muni's wandering here and there is not like a random meaningless event. He is purposely going here and there distributing auspiciousness. So it's the devotee factor, the presence of the devotee in the material cosmos that causes justice. Therefore, it's so important that devotees wander here and there, apparently by chance. They are the ones who bear fairness. They are the ones that bear justice. Because if someone crosses the path of a devotee, knowingly or unknowingly, their life is never the same. I always remember the first time I heard Prabhupada's statement. I was in Los Angeles in 1976, and a new tape had just come from the tape ministry. It was back in the early days, almost early days, ISKCON. I knew the devotee who put out the tapes for the tape ministry. His name was Disha. He explained to me, this is what I do. I just take the tapes that are coming in. I play them real fast. The tapes I hear, there's laughter. That's the ones I send out. So, the Hare Krishnas. At least he was putting something out. So, anyway, this particular tape had some laughter on, so he released it. And but also on this tape, Prabhupada was explaining that if someone takes one of his books in hand from a book distributor and simply appreciates, this is nice, very good, doesn't buy the book, hands the book back to the distributor, that person gets a human form of life in the next birth. I couldn't believe it. I just played it over and over again. So how then can you say that Krishna is unfair? This mercy of a devotee, the mercy of the Shastra, is far more important than any so-called remembering of exactly what you did wrong in your previous life that's caused a corresponding punishment in this life. We need to get over that hang up and look at what's really going on. Narada Muni's wanderings, the wanderings of the servants of Narada Muni through parampara, their auspiciousness, their mercy is the illuminating factor. So just think, someone just takes a book in their hand and nice, looks interesting, very well done, and doesn't buy it. So Prabhupada said they get it automatically. By that appreciation, they get a human form in the next life. He went on further to explain that this is Shraddha. Shraddha is not exactly faith as we conceive of it in Western terms. Shraddha, that means you believe a certain thing. No, Shraddha begins with just respect, appreciation. The smallest kind of affinity. This is nice. Beautiful book. Interesting. Yeah, not today. But that is the beginning of Shraddha. And therefore the person, due to the potency of Srila Prabhupada's books, gets a human form of life in the next birth. Another statement Prabhupada said, which someone might consider, well, this is sounds a bit presumptuous. He said, taking shelter of my books is the same as taking shelter of Krishna because my books are as good as Krishna. quite a weighty statement. My books are as good as Krishna, so taking shelter of my books is the same as taking shelter of Krishna. Therefore, someone can just take one of those books in their hand, appreciate it, not buy it, and their whole karmic, the whole web of karma is rearranged. This is the amazing thing. So, once again, we need to abandon our misconceptions that illumination in this world has to work a certain way. We should be aware of exactly what we did wrong so that we will not make that mistake again. Whoever said that experience teaches you anything? What does Shukadeva Goswami say in the beginning of the second canto? Pashyanapi na pashyati. although we are sufficiently experienced, we still don't see. This is humiliating. We are sufficiently experienced, yet we don't see. So there's no correlation between experience and seeing. What correlates with seeing is contact with the devotee, submitting to the super soul in the heart, and submitting to the shastra. That is what lets you see. So we can save ourselves a lot of trouble by understanding these points, and then we'll get real insight into how Krishna's jurisprudence system works, how Krishna's enlightenment system works. He doesn't enlighten through the material energy. If that was the case, if by contact with the material energy you could become illuminated, then wherever you look in the material energy, you would be able to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But that's not the case. Something else is required. Because it's not the job of the material energy, even though it's Krishna's energy, to give revelation, to give illumination. It's the nescience potency. Avijjakarma samgyanya. It fills you with nescience, fills you with godless activities. Well, why? You shouldn't have come in contact with it. Just like in Russia, everyone knows, you shouldn't have gone anywhere near where there's a policeman or the court. You did it, so you've got complications, you've got problems. And you're going to have to pay your way out. So the people there understand. It's not, you don't get justice by what the judge decides simply based on so-called facts. Justice means who pays the most. That's a prevalent conception. That conception is prevalent throughout the world. What is Krishna's system? If you want to be illuminated, if you want to be educated, it's not through experience by contact with the material energy. It is by connection to the super soul. It is by connection to the shastra and connection to a devotee. So this is a completely different way of viewing reality than what our conditioned mentality will tell us.